This podcast is intended for investment professionals only. All investing involves risk. Hello and welcome to L&G Talks Asset Management. Like it or not, AI has become impossible for investors to ignore, with estimates suggesting AI-related spending was responsible for virtually all US GDP growth in the first quarter of this year. My name's Harry Brooks, and today I'm joined by a trio of L&G experts to discuss how AI is affecting the labour market, whether it could shift the balance of global power, and what all of this means for investors in practical terms. My guests are James Carrick, a senior economist and strategist, Matthew Roger, an economist, and Andre Piok, a fund manager. Thanks for joining me today, everyone. Andre, I know that you lecture at a university here in London, so I'd like to start by asking you about the jobs market for younger people and whether AI is having an impact. What are you hearing?
Yeah, it's very interesting because I've been lecturing for over 10 years now, and I can really see that it's getting tougher for students to find those entry-level jobs. And it's a number of things that can explain this. First, some automation in terms of LinkedIn and how easy it is to get notified about new positions and apply with a single click means that we could put a position on and then get 700, 800 applications by the evening. So it's much harder for students to stand out. Also, AI is being used to screen the CVs of those student applicants, and some students might be better at anticipating what to say, what not to say for AI to screen you into the interview. And as Matthew told me, actually CVs written by AI, I have a higher chance of being screened positively. And then in the end, also firms used to use a lot of interns, offered placements for people to come in, do maybe more repetitive tasks, but then also learn on the job. A lot of those tasks will be automated. It will be done with the help of Copilot. So that also reduces the number of positions that they can apply. So it definitely changes, and it changes quite quickly.
Not an easy time to be a grad by the sounds of it. James, you've written an article that's going to feature in our upcoming quarterly outlook on this subject. Does the research that you've done support the anecdotal evidence from Andre?
Yes, Harry. Unfortunately, the research does back up Andre's experience. It's a tough outlook for recent graduates. But it's a double-edged sword, as it suggests that we are seeing technological adoption, which ultimately raises living standards. So yeah, the latest academic research using the biggest data set suggests that younger people are struggling to find jobs in areas most exposed to AI automation. But it's not all bad news, because they are finding jobs in occupations where AI augments their productivity. Now, some argue that it's just a weak macro backdrop of economic uncertainty, high interest rates, which has caused firms to pause hiring. So it's a typical cyclical phenomenon which disproportionately hurts new entrants to the labour market, i.e. recent graduates and school leavers. However, the authors find that even within a particular firm, hiring is shifting away from AI-exposed roles. And that suggests companies are testing out new technology, which ultimately will deliver higher living standards.
You've also looked at industries that are in secular decline as a way of modelling the possible impact of technological disruption. What do you think black cabs, bookshops, these kind of industries can tell us here?
Yeah, so the ageing of a workforce, consistent with no hiring of recent graduates in a particular occupation, is consistent with technological change. So I was exploring whether or not we needed to see a recession for technological adoption to occur. For example, travel agent employment collapsed in 2001 and 2002 after the dot-com crash. But looking at licensed taxi drivers and bookstore employment, those industries aged and declined in a non-recessionary period as SatNav and Kindles rolled out. Indeed, the taxi industry is a great example of hope versus fear from technological change. SatNavs devalued the knowledge and experience that skilled cab drivers had, but it augmented the driving skills of others, leading to a doubling of hours worked in the taxi industry as Uber rolled out. So lower prices and more output for society, but unfortunately a huge setback for those skilled incumbents. And that's pretty similar to how the first factories undermined the old guilds and craftsmen back in the 1700s.
That makes sense. I like the framing, James, of hope versus fear. Matthew, you've also been exploring the impact of AI on the real world. And one of the themes that you've picked up is the concentration of AI capability in just two countries, the US and China. You've cited research that between them, they account for around 80% of total AI computation. We've already seen the effects of AI leadership in equity markets with a handful of giant companies making huge share price gains. But what could a concentration of AI dominance mean for the balance of geopolitical power?
So the geopolitical angle here, I think, is something that is remarkably under-discussed, and yet I think it's very important. Technological dominance and geopolitical power are often cut very close together. So a large part of the period in which we're currently living in was shaped in that kind of 1945 to 1951 period, when the US was acting as a so-called singleton, when it had was the only country to have a monopoly on the atomic bomb. And those were very fraught debates at that time, and the institutions that were birthed were marked by a certain US dominance that it was only really able to wield because it had that kind of technological, if you like, that power embedded within it. So fast forwarding to today, the numbers you cited were from a research organization called Epoch AI, and they essentially found that somewhere in the region of about 80 to 85% of all current computational power is concentrated inside the US and China. The current rankings are strongly dominated within the US at the moment, with China, if you like, a respectable second, and most other countries being in a kind of distant tail. There is, I think, a somewhat limited appreciation in current markets about how useful these things are from a global geopolitical risk perspective. So you might say, you know, computational power that helps states make decisions, that, you know, informs and upgrades military strength and intelligence assets and whatnot, in addition to the more benign use cases involving economic expansion and cultural reach and all those other things. And it may well be the case that if you're an individual country that's looking into this space, you say, I'm not sure if how winner takes all this race is, but it may well be the case that the country that arrives first is a substantial winner here. And so that might encourage a certain amount of riskiness on the part of individual actors in this space, right? So if you're Russia, or if you're North Korea, for example, neither of which are taking substantial AI platform at the moment, they could be incentivized, at least in the short term, to prevent that kind of US-dominated world order, US-China-dominated world order that is often spoken about in this AI space.
Okay, you've also looked at the incredible sums that are being invested at the moment in data centers particularly, and how this compares with previous booms in fiber optics in the 1990s, or even railroads back in the 1850s. Can you give us a sense of the scale of investment that's being undertaken and the macroeconomic implications of it?
So there's two ways to think about it, and both of those are really quite remarkable, the pace of the investment. The first is as a physical phenomenon. So Stargate Abilene, which is an OpenAI-based data center in Texas that comprises about the same landmass as Lower Manhattan, and that was wilderness a year ago and is now being turned into, you know, one of the most advanced data centers on the planet, all in the space of a year. And that's relatively small by data center standards. So you look at Meta, which is building data centers the size of Manhattan Island itself. So it's very, very large. There's also an alternative way of looking at it, which is the sheer CapEx dollar spend. The US Census Bureau has data out that since about ChatGPT's launch, somewhere in the region of $0.9 trillion has been spent on AI and data center CapEx from then to now. And there are some who argue that even that number is undercounting it. So that's not taking into account things like the changing prices of GPUs. That's not taking into account various land and labor costs associated with building the data centers, and indeed the kind of multiplier or spillover effects on other industries. And there are people who arrive who've done those calculations and who arrive at a number that is somewhere in the region of 1.5% of GDP. And that is at least comparable to the numbers that was reached in the kind of early 2000s fiber optic cable boom, and at least being comparable, if slightly smaller, to the kind of railway build out that took place in the 1850s. I think one of the things that's interesting about the build out is that, you know, a great many things were built prior CapEx build outs. And so we got, but no one thinks that, oh, we got a lot of pretty railroad bridges or a lot of cool looking servers. We in fact got something much more useful, which was the utility that we got out of those products and of that investment. So I think something to watch from our perspective is exactly what capabilities these models are capable of generating inside these data centers that are being built at the moment. And I think that, you know, that will be something really potent and powerful to watch in that time.
Thanks, Matthew. As you say, some fundamental questions that remain unanswered for now there. Andre, I wanted to come back to you to ask you a question that you're probably sick to death of answering. How does the situation today compare with the dot-com craze of the late 1990s? Would you say there's a bubble in AI stocks?
Yeah, it's definitely tempting, isn't it, to make those comparisons? I think there is a lot of attention currently on that capital expenditure, which was one of the features of what happened 25 years ago. People also talk about the aggressive accounting when they describe the tech bubble, same with that mania for IPOs. And I think on the IPO side, this is something that we don't see yet. And even when you account for the investments that are done in private markets or venture capital as a percentage of GDP, yes, that might be high, but it's not unprecedented. The other thing that we sometimes hear as well is the bubble models. Now, this is handy in terms of describing different stages of the bubble, but it hasn't been tested as a predictive tool. So we would also caution against using such tools which simply describe the reality rather than tell you how this reality might evolve going forward. So for now, as Matthew mentioned, we're very much focusing on the viability when it comes to the business of those AI companies, any strategies to monetize those technologies, for example, a combination of advertising with search engine. And it's still too early to tell how AI will impact other sectors. Where are we going to see the greatest benefits in terms of productivity gains? I think it's still early days.
We've mentioned equity market concentration a couple of times now, so it feels like a good time to tackle it head on. It must put you in a challenging position as a fund manager when you see huge gains in just a small handful of AI stocks. What's your approach to sizing exposure to these very big companies?
So when you listen to the trends that James and Matthew mentioned, I think it's really important when you construct your portfolios that you have enough in high growth equities. But it doesn't mean just doubling up on your Magnificent Seven exposure, because these are the companies that already did really, really well, which means that it's increasingly difficult for them to exceed ever-growing expectations. So for us, the theme looks interesting, but it needs to be accessed in a diversified way. Also, when you look at the global equity indices, a lot of index investors benefited from the rise of those largest companies, like Nvidia, like Microsoft. But now they're sitting on a much higher weight in those. So you're essentially betting on the trend that happened to now repeat into the future. Some of it also is one of the common behavioral biases, like the recency bias. So for us, I think you can still access the theme, but do it in a much more explicit, targeted way. You can use a sector future or use even an ETF, which is equally weighted and so gives you the exposure to, say, AI as a theme, but without taking bets on individual companies.
Really interesting points, Andre, about diversification and the historical performance of the Magnificent Seven. Thank you so much for your time today, Andre, Matthew and James. And if you'd like to stay on top of our latest research into AI, visit blog.lng.com and be sure to look out for our upcoming Q4 Outlook.
As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. The views expressed in this podcast are those of L&G's Asset Management Division, as at the date of publication. This podcast is for informational purposes only, and we're not soliciting any action based on it. The information discusses general market, economic, or political issues, or industry or sector trends. It does not constitute research or investment, legal or tax advice. It is not recommendation or advertisement to buy or sell securities or pursue a particular investment strategy.
energy. Assumptions, opinions, and estimates are provided for illustrative purposes only. There is no guarantee that any forecast made will come to pass. No party shall have any right of action against LNG in relation to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this podcast. Where this podcast contains third-party information, the accuracy or completeness of such information cannot be guaranteed, and we accept no responsibility or liability in respect of such information, not for distribution to any person in any jurisdiction where such distribution would be contrary to local law or regulations. Copyright 2025. Legal and General Investment Management Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. Unless otherwise stated, references herein to LNG, we and us are meant to capture the global conglomerate that includes, in the European Economic Area, LGIM Managers Europe Limited, authorised and regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland as a UCITS management company pursuant to European Communities, Undertaking for Collective Investment in Transferable Securities Regulations 2011 as amended, and as an Alternative Investment Fund Manager pursuant to the European Union Alternative Investment Fund Managers Regulations 2013 as amended. In the USA, Legal and General Investment Management America, Inc., a US SEC-regulated investment advisor. In Japan, Legal and General Investment Management Japan, KK, a Japan FSA-registered investment management company. In Hong Kong, issued by Legal and General Investment Management Asia Limited, which is licensed by the Securities and Futures Commission. And in Singapore, issued by LGIM Singapore Pte Limited, company registration number 20223187 6W, which is regulated by the Monetary Authority of Singapore. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. To find more content, you can check us out on LinkedIn or on our website.